This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. That's the Modern Jazz Quartet, recorded in 1955. Percy Heath, a member of the Modern Jazz Quartet and a bass player who worked with most of the leading jazz artists of the second half of the 20th century, died yesterday of bone cancer. He was 81. Percy Heath was born in Wilmington, North Carolina in 1923 and grew up in Philadelphia. He and his two brothers, Jimmy and Albert, all became noted jazz musicians. In 1950, Percy and Jimmy moved to New York and joined Dizzy Gillespie's band. 2 years later, Percy and three other Gillespie sidemen, Milt Jackson, John Lewis, and Kenny Clark, formed the Modern Jazz Quartet. The MJQ, as fans call it, stayed together until 1974 with only one change in its roster. Then Percy teamed with siblings Jimmy and Albert as the Heath Brothers and played with them until the Modern Jazz Quartet reunited in the early 1980s. In the mid-90s, when Percy finally tired of touring, the MJQ quietly faded away. Percy's brothers are still alive, and he's also survived by his wife, June, and their three sons. By his own count, Percy Heath played on more than 300 records during his lifetime. He played with Charlie Parker, Thelonious Monk, John Coltrane, Ornette Coleman, and Miles Davis. During World War II, he was a pilot and a member of the now-famous Tuskegee Airmen. Terry spoke with Percy Heath in 1986. She asked him about becoming a pilot.
You were, drafted into the military during World War II, and if I'm not mistaken, you were one of the first black fighter pilots.
I wasn't one of the first. I was one of the 500 that got their wings and were commissioned from Tuskegee. It was then the Tuskegee Army Air Force, which was also segregated. And ironically... when I was about 18 years old and registered for the draft, I was working with my father, an apprentice mechanic. And I decided with this mechanical knowledge that I was going to go down and volunteer to become an aircraft mechanic. And I went through all this physical and booga-booga and examinations and everything and specified what I'd like to be and whatnot. And... this at the end of the interview, this guy stamped 4F on my papers there, and he says, you don't weigh enough. I was really a frail, small person with a violin. You know, I had a rough time getting through school like that, too, and named Percy on top of that. But anyhow, instead of this sergeant telling me, look, we don't have any place to send a black man in this segregated Air Force to become a mechanic. Instead of him telling me that, he told me I was underweight and I was rejected for that reason. So I went back home and told Mama, well, I don't have to worry about getting drafted, Mama. I'm too skinny, and they rejected me. And about a year and a half later, my number came up, and I went through the same physical. And I told the guy, I said, Mama, I said, well, I'll be right back. I'm just going down here, formality, you know. They're not going to take me. And this guy stamped 1A on my papers. I said, wait a minute, what happened? He says, oh, don't worry, we'll fatten you up. And this was being drafted into the regular Army, which was mainly serving in supplies or something like that. And they had one tank division that was black, and not very many... of the combat groups were black. But all of a sudden, in that interim, some congressman had spoken up or something and said, why are there no black pilots? And so for tokenism, they gave us the school in Tuskegee. In the meantime, I made a score that actually qualified me to become a pilot, bombardier, or navigator. So anyhow, I made it, and ironically... instead of a mechanic, I was a fighter pilot.
So you came back from World War II as a second lieutenant and fighter pilot. Did that give you any new ideas of what you wanted to do professionally?
It made up my mind for me, Terry, that after being an officer and a gentleman and flying airplanes around and having that status, that I didn't want to be an automobile mechanic again. So that's when I had to decide to go back to music, which there was an interim of about 10 years during which period I had a period that sang on a Sunday morning kitty hour, the sepia kitty hour, if you... everything in Philadelphia was so segregated. You know, I, you think about it, it's amazing that they call it the city of brotherly love, you know.
Like even the kids' shows were segregated.
Yeah, because even the kitty hours were segregated. Like there was a Horn and Hardart kitty hour on Sunday morning, and then there was, right after that, was the Parisian Taylor kitty hour, which the black kids appeared on. And it's really a funny city to be called the seat of liberty and government and all this. So that's really one reason why I left here in 1949. I was in an integrated situation then, and policemen were stopping us on the street asking my wife, since then she's become my wife, was she all right? And we're coming from a neighborhood movie, holding hands, you know, and things like that.
You became the house bassist at the Downbeat Club in Philadelphia. While you were playing at the Downbeat, your home, I think, became a gathering place for musicians from town and for visiting musicians, too.
It became that, and it was, like I say, with the drums later when Tootie started playing. It was set up in the living room. It was always a jam session of some kind, and then there was always record listening in the basement. We had the basement fixed up so we could do it later at night, you know, and tune into Symphony Sid and programs like that from New York. But Jimmy's band members used to come down and rehearse at the house. And
did your parents mind, or did the neighbors complain?
My mother was the greatest lady that ever lived. She, you know, later on it became, you'd wake up after being up late at night. We'd wake up a little later, 10, 11 o'clock in the morning. My mother would be down there playing Charlie Parker, doing her housework, you know. It was really beautiful. She enjoyed that music, and they were very proud of our achievements in that field, because being involved with music and seeing us develop like that and become known.
Why did you leave Philadelphia?
Everybody has to leave Philadelphia to in the music business to even be heard of. Otherwise, you could be around here for years and years and be as great as people who are internationally known, and you could be in Philadelphia and nobody would know of you. It's close to New York, and a lot of people came here because of that during that period, you know, Terry. They came here to, because it was a little cheaper, yet it was only 90 miles away from the big town where you had to make it eventually. So that, and along with that pressure with my fiancé at the time,
she was white, and it was hard to be an integrated couple in the city.
It was very difficult in Philadelphia to do it. You know, they closed the Downbeat eventually. They planted some kids up there underage and had them served. And they closed it because it was just a mecca for integration, and that music bred integration, and it was anti-policy in Philadelphia, really. I think that's why they closed the Downbeat.
When you moved to New York, you played with a lot of the top musicians. You played with Charlie Parker, for instance, and I'm sure he had been one of the inspirations for you. Was it hard when you were actually playing with him in the band together? Was he still like a hero or a model to you? Were you awed by him at all?
Of course. And, you know, to play with Charlie Parker, you really felt useless. You just hoped that you wouldn't do something to mess up what was happening. Your job was just to stay out of the way, you know. And I got that feeling going back to jamming with the pros at the Downbeat. I stayed up there a year or so, a year and a half. And through that, Howard McGee came through there and played with that rhythm section. And he had heard of Jimmy and his band, and Bird had played with Jimmy's band. Jimmy had a great band around Philadelphia. They had transcribed all of the charts from Billy Eckstein and Dizzy's band, and this band really sounded good. So everybody who came to town knew about Jimmy's band, and they had dubbed him Little Bird with his alto. Coltrane was in the band. Benny Golson was in there. There was a trombone player, Mike Goldberg was an alto saxophonist, and there were some other players that around town, white players. It was an integrated band, too, as the music was. The music, the bebop era was the most interracial and, like, American product, if you want to use that word, but creation that ever was. And this defiance of the rule of segregation was probably what held it back for a long time.
Let me ask you a little bit about playing with Thelonious Monk. Did he point you in any different directions playing with him, since his playing was so idiosyncratic?
Monk's music, to me, required me to do exactly what I knew at the time, which was to play fundamental bass notes and indicate each progression as was laid out in the chord changes. So to play with Monk was a joy, because my note became really the foundation of his harmonic inferences. And so to play with Monk was beautiful with me. And the fact to play with all those guys, I was going to school, Terry, the whole 10 years of my first association with almost everybody in the jazz bebop era at that time.
Bass player Percy Heath, speaking with Terry Gross in 1986. Heath died yesterday at the age of 81. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're listening to Terry's 1986 interview with Percy Heath, bass player and founding member of the Modern Jazz Quartet. Heath died yesterday at age 81. Before we return to their conversation, here's the Modern Jazz Quartet, recorded in 1952, the year it was formed.
The Modern Jazz Quartet didn't want to play clubs and played concert halls instead, and also frequently dressed in informal attire and in tuxedos. Was everyone in the group in agreement on that? Did you want to do that?
Why not? I had been getting dressed up all my life. I've got pictures of me. I go back now and people say, don't you ever get tired of wearing a tie? No, when I get dressed up, since I was 10 years old, I put on a tie. I got pictures of me, you know, with knickers on with a tie. So what is a tie? What does that mean? Why should you be in your shirt sleeves if you're a performer on a stage? Well, you know, when I was growing up in Philadelphia, our source of pride was the black bands, the black orchestras that used to come to the Lincoln Theater on South Street. It was on Lombard Street, Broad and Lombard. That was on the Chitlin' Circuit. You know about that. So-called Chitlin' Circuit. That's the black folks' entertainment circuit. There were several theaters in that circuit, one in Chicago, Baltimore, Washington, New York, and cities like that, and Philadelphia. And here's little old Percy. Every week I heard every band that came through Philadelphia. I met Fats Waller, you know, and Louis Armstrong. Every time they stepped out on the stage, they were sharp, baby. And that pride of a performer in jazz music, to be clean, to be sharp, not to look like a member of the orchestra, of the audience, I can't get away from it, that's all.
The Modern Jazz Quartet combined some classical style and jazz, and was, you know, really known as one of, like, the first third stream type groups. Yeah, you're going to say something.
No, it's okay, Terry. Finish it. I know what you're saying, but, you know, these labels and...
Well, I guess what I was going to ask you, though, yeah.
And stuff
I was
like
going to ask
that.
You if you had to change your technique. Did you have to change your technique?
I didn't have
in
any
way,
technique. I was going to school then every day. Every chart that John Lewis wrote for me was a challenge for me to learn how to do it and say what it was supposed to say and do my what was relegated as my responsibility as far as harmonic purity and get the best sound you can get and the intonation and on time and play your passage and speak up when you're supposed to and back up when you're not supposed to be. You know what I mean? This was all integrated in the writing of the music. How it should sound was left up to the musical director, and poor little Purse was just trying to do it. You know what I mean? The best I could. And that challenge would come, and as soon as I would accomplish something like Concord, which was a very difficult piece of music for me at that time to even attempt with my limited study and whatnot. But I did it, and I've heard some records later where it had gotten so fast, I don't believe I played it. You know what I mean? And some of those older records, eventually what they evolved to after playing them 5 or 6 years, it's amazing some of those recordings. I don't believe I did it, really, Terry, at that stage of my development. But... as soon as I would accomplish that, up jumps another chart that was a little different and a little more challenging. Say, okay, you learned that, good. Now learn this.
How do you see the role of the bass in a quartet?
Okay. My idol, among my idols, is the father of all the bass players in the concept, Jimmy Blanton, who turned everything around in 1939 and 1940 with the Duke Ellington Organization, which was one of those groups that I went to the Lincoln to see, and this spotlight was put on this man, and he came down and played, and they kept him mic'd up in the band and whatnot. So my concept of a bass player in a group is to serve as a pulse and to imply harmonically what the progressions are in the song. I've never put too much emphasis on the soloing aspect of the bass, contrary to my admiration for Jimmy Blanton and Oscar Pettiford, Ray Brown, and the other soloists, even Scott LaFaro later, who came along, who was a saxophone player when I met him. And 3 years later, he was really tearing up the bass, you know. And Red Mitchell with his fingering concept, and Mingus, who was a teacher of mine for a few lessons. Milt Hinton, Pops Foster, all different stylists on the bass, but all very important people in dictating what direction the bass was going into. But I've always felt that my place was at home, at the bottom of things. My whole concept is to be one voice. Like in the modern jazz quartet, there's four lines that go along horizontally, as well as the vertical implications of motion of the music. But with that concept as being another voice on the stand, and generally a voice on which the other instruments build. I've never been able to get away from that concept, so that's the way I play the bass. I stick kind of close to the root of the matter. Like I was telling you about Monk, I felt so comfortable because the root was exactly what it called for, you know.
You were on the road maybe 10 out of 12 months a year for a long time.
For a while there we were gone.
How do you keep together a home life? Because you had a family, too, when you're on the road that much.
I was married to, and still I'm married to, a wonderful lady from Philadelphia, and June is her name. And she wanted to be my wife. She wanted to have our children, and she wanted to be their mother. And she wanted to have that home for me to come back to off the road. She wanted me to give this music to the world. And that's her contribution to it, too, because we have three sons, grown, and they're all doing what they want to do. They're not involved in music, but they can play. A couple of them can play.
Percy Heath, speaking with Terry Gross in 1986. He died yesterday at age 81. He's survived by his wife, June, and their three sons. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.